Kia ora tata, great to have you back. Welcome to 2023. It's great to welcome back David Littlewood, Dr. David Littlewood from Massey University, who's a military historian and researcher and lecturer. David's done other presentations for us in the past, working heavily in areas of military heritage and interest. And today's topic is looking at a conscripted society and a book that he's currently writing on the topic, which he hopes to launch next year. So many of us probably were a hangover from the old conscription during World War II into CMT, National Service, or what have you. So it'll be quite interesting to see the research that David's coming up with. But without further ado, I'll leave it over to you, David, and kick off. Thanks very much.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much for coming. So on the 30th of May, 1940, New Zealand Prime Minister Peter Fraser informed Parliament of his government's intentions to adopt sweeping powers of conscription over New Zealand's manpower and resources. And amongst the many things he said, in a struggle like this, it should be everything in. Everything we have and everything that we are. The country feels at the present time in this crisis that the voluntary system of recruitment, even if completely successful, does not apply fairly and does not embody that spirit of sacrifice that the country demands. So despite the obvious importance and the centrality to New Zealand's war effort that Fraser is describing here, the historical literature hasn't really reflected that in any great way. One thing that you notice if you read a lot of books and other publications on New Zealand in the Second World War is that conscription does not figure very much, far less than I would argue it should. Partly that's because a lot of the books focus on the initial period of voluntary recruitment. So the initial, what became to New Zealand was recruited by voluntary methods, and the voluntary system remained in place until July 1940. And a lot of books have quite a bit on that voluntary period. They look at why men volunteered, or perhaps why they didn't, and the initial formation of the various units that would become two New Zealand Division. But then they tend to follow those units as they sail overseas, as they assemble in Egypt or the UK, and as they gradually enter combat. Very few of them go back to New Zealand to consider how two New Zealand Division and subsequently three New Zealand Division were reinforced. And most of that reinforcement was by conscription. But a lot of the books don't really talk too much about that. The other area that is discussed quite a bit is the area of conscientious objection. So when New Zealand introduced conscription, a provision was included for conscientious objectors. People could object that they had a religious or other objection to fighting in war. That's had a lot of literature written about it. The men who argued for conscientious objection and their treatment has received a lot of attention. But statistically at least, conscientious objection is only a very small part of the conscription story. Only around 2% of the men who were balloted under conscription raised conscientious objections. So it's an important part of the story, but it's only quite a small statistical part of the story. The vast majority of New Zealanders who were called up under conscription were not, at least overtly, conscientious objectors. So there's not much about conscription in the literature. What there is in the literature tends to play down the extent of how it was done. So whereas Fraser was talking about everything in, you know, everyone needs to be mobilised, we need to mobilise the whole country under conscription, historians have tended to suggest that didn't really happen in practice. So they often compare what happened in New Zealand with what happened in Britain, and they talk about the extensive conscription of men and women in Britain, and they say that New Zealand never really lived up to that standard. So historians like Stephen Eldred Grigg, Deborah Montgomery, John Martin have said that no, New Zealand didn't really conscript its population to a significant degree, and certainly not as much as Britain. What I'm going to argue today is that both of those trends in the literature are quite problematic. I would argue that conscription is absolutely essential to the way New Zealand fights its war. It comes in July 1940, so it is the vast majority of the war. New Zealand conscripts its men for military service, or at least for army service. The voluntary period is much shorter, it's less than a year, whereas conscription is in place for 5 years for the military sphere. And as we'll see, conscription is also extended to include work within New Zealand, so people could be conscripted for jobs and moved around within employment under conscription. So I would argue that one of the crucial reasons why New Zealand is able to sustain such a heavy military contribution to the productive contribution to things like food for the troops in the Pacific is because of conscription and because of the way it's applied. And I think the literature really needs to reflect that a lot more than it does. And I would also argue that conscription in New Zealand is applied very extensively. I don't think the comparison to Britain is a very good comparison, because Britain is on the front line. Britain has been directly attacked. It's a very different society to New Zealand society. I would argue that the much more apt comparison is with the other settler colonies that are primarily removed away from the actual military conduct of the war, so Australia and Canada, seem to me to be much better and much more appropriate comparisons than Britain. And if we look at those in comparison to what happens in New Zealand, New Zealand's application of conscription is far more extensive than both Australia and Canada. So, as I've mentioned, conscription is not enforced straight away. So Britain has conscription in place from the very start of the Second World War, so as soon as war breaks out, Britain passes conscription legislation. As I've said, New Zealand doesn't start to conscript until the middle of 1940. There's a couple of reasons for that. One reason is that volunteers, at least initially, come forward in quite large numbers. So around 60,000 men volunteer before conscription comes in. So initially there's not really a need to conscript because enough volunteers are coming forward. Second is there's the phony war period in Europe. So there isn't really, after the initial panic and the fear of what the war was going to be like, once the attack on Poland has settled down and once the situation in Europe settles down, at least until the invasion of France, there's kind of that lull period where the recruitment and sending of more men doesn't seem as urgent as it had before. So that kind of causes the issue of conscription to drift a little bit. And finally, the government was quite concerned about what might happen if it tried to introduce conscription in New Zealand. Many of the members of the first Labour government who were in power, including Prime Minister Fraser, had actually been arrested during the First World War because of their own opposition to conscription and their own refusal to suggest it was an appropriate way of recruiting men for the army. And there was still a strong anti-conscription feeling in parts of the Labour Party and in parts of the trade union movement. So the government were concerned that if the case for conscription wasn't ironclad and if it didn't seem urgent to move to conscription, there might be quite a bit of resistance. So they tried to play for time to see what would happen. But it was coming. And I would argue it's clear fairly early on that the government is starting to think about conscription as really waiting for the right time to introduce it. You get statements from various ministers saying that if the number of volunteers starts to dry up, we will conscript. So they're kind of preparing the ground for several months before conscription actually comes in. The government takes action to try and fracture the various potential centres of resistance. So there's action against the Communist Party of New Zealand. Its printing press is destroyed and confiscated. There's a group called the Peace and Anti-Conscription Council, which is quite well supported in places like Wellington. The government takes action to restrict its activities and to try and break up its support as well. And there's also moves to try and tighten up discipline within the Labour Party. So you get things like the expulsion of John A. Lee and other dissidents are kind of brought into line to try and make sure that the government won't be hamstrung by opposition from within its own party if it introduces conscription. Perhaps the most crucial problem that's leading towards conscription is that volunteering starts to slow down. So while it's very rapid initially, By the time you get to the second and third echelons of two New Zealand division, there's a real scramble to try and raise enough men. And the third echelon is only just filled in time with enough volunteers. So already the number of volunteers is starting to dry up. If this is becoming a long war, and it's looking increasingly likely that it might be a long war, and volunteering is already starting to dry up, it's becoming increasingly plain that some form of conscription is going to be required. And increasingly the demand for conscription within parts of New Zealand society, particularly Farmers Union, Chambers of Commerce, the National Party starts to call for conscription, many other groups start to call for conscription. So there's a growing momentum behind it. So it's not really a huge surprise when on the 30th of May, Fraser announces to Parliament that his government is going to introduce conscription. It's been coming for a while. And when it does come in the middle of 1940, it's comprehensive from the very start. So whereas in the First World War, there had kind of been a parallel system when even after the introduction of conscription, men could still volunteer. So the two systems kind of ran in parallel. In the Second World War, the government ends volunteering for the army. So men could still volunteer for the Air Force and for the Navy, but voluntary recruitment for the army is completely ended. On the 22nd of July 1940, from that point on, army recruits will be conscripts, not volunteers. Every man between the ages of 20 and 46 is enrolled into what's called the General Reserve, and this will be the pool of men who will be eligible for conscription. The first division will consist of all the single men, so the men who aren't married, and those who have been married after the 1st of May 1940. The government didn't want men getting married to try and dodge conscription, so they put that provision in there. The second division would consist of all the married men, and the idea was the first division would be called up first, so the single men first, then you'd move on to the married men. Men between the ages of 20 and 46 could be called up for territorial service within New Zealand, so they would require to join the territorial units for a period initially set at 3 months, but they could only serve within New Zealand. But men who were between 20 and 40 were also eligible for overseas service. So this is a crucial distinction, as we'll see from Australia and Canada, that from the very start of conscription, New Zealand conscripts between the age of 20 and 40 can be sent to fight anywhere in the world for the duration of the conflict. So they're overseas. There is a mechanism for exemption. So any man who's called up under conscription can appeal for exemption. But exemption is only on an individual basis. So in Britain, you have whole industries and whole groups of men who are automatically exempted because their occupation is deemed sufficiently important. The war effort that they shouldn't be sent off to fight. In New Zealand, every man who wants exemption has to apply as an individual before he can get it. There's no group exemption. So from the very start, it's a very comprehensive system, and as we'll see later, much more comprehensive than what's introduced in Australia and Canada. So having gained the power of conscription, the government wastes no time in putting it into practice. So the first territorial ballot, so that's for the 20 to 46 year olds who can only serve within New Zealand, is held in October 1940. The first overseas ballot, so that's the 20 to 40 year olds who can be sent to serve anywhere, is held just 2 months later. And things then move really quickly. So every single first division man, so that's every single single man, every single man between 20 and 46, that's 123,000 of them, is balloted by the end of 1941. So within, 14 months, every single man has been balloted for conscription. That doesn't mean they all go into the army, because there's a fitness criteria and there's exemptions, but they've all been made available. They've all had to prove their case as to why they should or shouldn't go into the army. So it's moving really quickly. Unemployment in New Zealand practically disappears, and does so for the duration of the war, because because so many men are being called up. So you can see from the very start, even in the first year of its operation, conscription is used extensively as a military recruitment tool. And it gets even more extensive. So once Japan enters into the war in December 1941, there's tremendous angst and fear within New Zealand about what that means, fear that New Zealand might come under direct attack. So there's a real push to increase the extent of the war effort and to increase the extent of conscription. So what happens in 1942, and this is a complete departure from the First World War, because in the First World War conscription had only been used for military recruitment, but in the Second World War, conscription is now extended to what's called industrial conscription. So the workforce will be conscripted and can be moved around and mobilized and remodeled according to the government's wishes. So industries within New Zealand can be classed as essential. And if an industry is classed as an essential industry, so essential for the war effort, no one can leave their employment within that industry without permission from a district manpower officer, and employers cannot sack their workers without permission. So whereas the workforce in New Zealand had been highly transient, there was a lot of inflow and outflow from different occupations, in any industry that's classed as essential, that inflow and outflow will now be heavily restricted because it has to be approved by the manpower office. There's also a power of direction. So manpower officers can now say to people, the work you're doing isn't essential enough for the war effort, you need to go work in this other place. So men and women can actually be taken from their employment and legally required to go and work somewhere else if the manpower officer directs. So there's also a process of restriction. So certain employers, particularly those who are in non-essential industries, can actually be banned from hiring new staff unless they get permission first. Anyone who breaches a manpower order, so if there's a case of absenteeism, if someone fails to comply with the direction, or if an employer is found to have hired someone without permission, they can be prosecuted, they can be fined, they can even be sent to prison, although that's quite rare, but it does happen in a few cases. Even more notable is that industrial conscription, not military conscription, but industrial conscription is applied to women. So women in essential industries are subject to the same restrictions. They can't move their employment unless they get permission. And women are also eligible for direction. So they can be sent from one job to another, and they can also be fined and prosecuted if they break the rules. So again, this is a major departure from the First World War, and obviously begins to strike at the very heart of some of the ideas around different gender roles within society. At the same time as industrial conscription is brought in, the fear of Japan and Japan's entry into the war leads to an extension of military conscription. So the entire territorial force, so that's all the men who've been balloted for service within New Zealand, are called up en masse, and will be required to serve for the period of the emergency. Ballots are now held for general service, so anyone who's balloted can now be sent overseas, can be sent to fight anywhere in the world. There's no longer the territorial overseas distinction. And again, the conscription of the 2nd Division proceeds extremely rapidly, so that by the end of November 1942, every single man and every single married man within New Zealand between the ages of 20 and 46 has been balloted for military service. So that's around 275,000. They've all been called up. They're not all going into the army, because I said there's fitness and exemption criteria, but they've all been made available, and they've all had to prove their case whether or not they should join or not. Conscription is also extended to the Home Guard. So that's the civil defence organisation of men who are not deemed fit enough to join the army. And they also have conscription for the Emergency Reserve Corps, which is a civil defence organisation responsible for firefighting and air raid warnings and those kinds of things, should New Zealand come under direct attack. So in 1942, the conscription of New Zealand really ramps up in both the military and the industrial spheres. 1943, there is some bit more room for manoeuvre because it becomes clear that Japan is unlikely to attack New Zealand directly, though it takes a while for that to sink in. So there is a gradual reduction in the home forces, so that's the territorial force and the home guard. They're gradually scaled back as Japan is pushed back in the Pacific. So that frees up a few more men that could have been used to relieve some of the manpower shortage. But the government effectively forgoes the opportunity by gathering together and reinforcing the existing New Zealand forces in the Pacific theatre into a new army division, 3 New Zealand division, which will be made available for combat duties in the Pacific theatre. And obviously, if you create and reinforce a division, it has to be continuously reinforced, so that puts even more pressure on the manpower situation. And as I said, all the eligible men have now been called up. You know, the 1st and the 2nd division has been exhausted. So the only way you can get more men for military service is either to cancel exemptions, and that happens, or you've got men who are coming of age, you know, who are turning 20, but there's not that many of them. So things really start to become stretched in 1943 when New Zealand is trying to maintain 2 army divisions, and of course the Navy and Air Force who are voluntary recruited as well. That's taking men away as well. So the number of employment directions, so that's men and women being directed to particular employment, is really ramped up. Because so many holes are starting to appear in the labour force, because so many men are being pushed into the army, they're really having to try to fill the gaps by requiring men and women to move from non-essential industries and putting them in essential industries. 1944, again, the pressure continues. It becomes clear that New Zealand's taken on too much. It simply can't maintain 2 army divisions, an air force, a navy, and feed the growing Allied forces in the Pacific with farm produce. So the 3rd division is gradually wound down, although it takes most of 1944 for that to happen. So throughout 1944, there's still huge numbers of directions. People are being sent all sorts of places. Even in the final year of the war, 1945, the pressure doesn't leave off because the government introduced the so-called replacement scheme, which is where long-service men in 2 divisions, so that's the division that's by now fighting in Italy, men who've been serving since the start of the war or for more than 3 years, there's a scheme introduced to bring them home. There's a feeling that they've done their bit. They should be given the opportunity to come back. But how do you replace them if you've already exhausted all your men? So there's a real attempt to further comb out the number of exempted men, even though many of those men are in essential industries. So again, the net, the manpower force has to be stretched even more thinly than it already has been. I should make a special mention of the case regarding Māori, because Māori in the Second World War are not subject to military conscription. The government had thought about it, but it decided because of the significant amount of unrest that had greeted a limited form of Māori conscription in the First World War, and there was a feeling that it wouldn't be worth it. So they didn't apply military conscription to Māori, provided that Māori volunteering for 28th Battalion remained strong, which it did throughout most of the war. But Māori men and women were subject to industrial conscription. And an organisation set up in 1942 called the Māori War Effort Organisation to coordinate and manage the industrial conscription of Māori, so moving Māori men and women to essential industries. And there's a lot of Māori control of that. Some historians have argued that the Māori War Effort Organisation could have formed a blueprint for after the war, giving Māori more autonomy, more chance to run their own affairs. The government doesn't really do that, but the War Effort Organisation is successful in moving and helping Māori into essential industries, and that's part of the growing urbanisation of Māori that's taking place. So the statistics alone, obviously statistics can't tell the whole story, but they are striking when it comes to conscription. So during the course of the war, 312,000 New Zealand men are balloted for conscription. So that's their name is drawn out of the ballot. They're eligible to join the army unless they get exemption or they're medically unfit. It's a little bit tricky to work out exactly what proportion of the New Zealand Army in the Second World War are conscripts, because the statistics aren't great, and there's some movement of men who are initially volunteers, but then they're unfit, but then they come back again as conscripts, and some people go the other way. So it's a little tricky, but I've crunched the numbers, and as far as I can determine, at least 62% of the New Zealand Army in the Second World War are conscripts, not volunteers. And I think that's probably a low estimate. So the historiography focuses overwhelmingly on those New Zealanders who were volunteers, and of course their stories should be told. But it's important to recognise that the majority of the New Zealand soldiers, and that includes the ones fighting in North Africa, Italy, etc., are conscripts, not volunteers. I mean, that just doesn't come through in the historiography at all. And I think it's a real omission. Plus, as I said, men were also conscripted for the Home Guard and the Emergency Reserve Corps. So it's clear to me that conscription is fundamental to New Zealand's ability to sustain such a large army contribution to the war from such a relatively small population. You know, two army divisions for a couple of years. You know, it couldn't have done it without conscription. Okay. Industrial conscription is also extensive. So, industries are declared essential, and as I said, if you're in an essential industry, you can't move jobs without permission, and you can't be sacked unless your employer gets permission. That covered around 40% of the workforce. 255,000 New Zealanders were in those essential industries. Those direction orders, where men or women are legally required to switch employment, leave their current employment, take new employment, over 166,000 of those. And as I said, people could be refused and employers could be refused to take on additional workers. So again, industrial conscription is fundamental to the way the government and the manpower authorities reconfigure and remould New Zealand's workforce throughout the war. And again, I think it's impossible to see how New Zealand could possibly have sustained its war effort to the extent that it does, particularly by 1944 and 1945, without these mechanisms and without them being used so extensively. And I think the situation in New Zealand becomes even more stark when we compare it to, as I said, what I consider the most apt comparisons of Australia and Canada. So in Australia, what happens in the Second World War is very much determined by what had happened in the First World War, where the question of conscription had been hugely divisive. There had been two referenda about whether Australia should conscript for overseas service in 1916 and 1917. Both had been defeated by narrow margins, but there had been tremendous civil unrest, violence, agitation between those who wanted no and those who wanted yes. The angst and the attempt to introduce conscription shattered the Labour Party, really ruined it as a political force for a number of years in Australia. So by the time you get to the Second World War, for many in Australia, particularly on the political left, the idea of no conscription for overseas service is really an article of faith. It's something they're absolutely committed to. So when Australia does introduce military conscription in 1940, it's made explicit within the relevant legislation that conscripts can only serve within Australia and its territories of Papua and New Guinea. So Australian conscripts cannot be sent overseas beyond Papua New Guinea. So all the Australians who serve in Europe, North Africa, Greece, they're all volunteers, not conscripts. So effectively in the Second World War, Australia raises two armies. You've got the Australian Imperial Force, the Second Australian Imperial Force, said that fights in Europe, North Africa, they're volunteers. You've got the Home Forces, so the forces based in Australia, or that do the fighting in Papua New Guinea and other parts of the Pacific. They're quite a lot of conscripts, some volunteers, but mostly conscripts. So that there's the big distinction there in the application of overseas conscription that means it's more extensive in New Zealand. There is a slight modification in January 1943. By that time, John Curtin is Prime Minister. He's a Labour Prime Minister, and he's also someone who had been very strongly against overseas conscription in the First World War. In 1943, he stuns the Australian Labour Party by saying that the boundaries for a conscript service should be extended, and he has a real fight on his hands to get it through the Australian Labour Party. So by the time he does manage to get it through, the boundaries are extended, but they're only extended to what's called the Southwest Pacific Zone. So there's a Southwest Pacific area, which is a military command under Douglas MacArthur, which is the black area, but the Southwest Pacific Zone is even less than that because it doesn't go above the equator. So conscript service is only really extended to Java, Borneo, and parts of the Celebes and other Pacific Islands. It's actually a military nullity because no Australian conscripts actually end up serving beyond what had been the original boundaries because MacArthur prefers to use American forces for his forward campaigns and kind of leaves the Australians with a mopping up behind. So the boundaries are extended, but it's only in the most limited and truncated way, and certainly nothing like the New Zealand provision. Industrial conscription is applied in Australia. So in 1942, they set up their own manpower directorate with some powers of industrial conscription. But for the first year of the manpower directorate's existence, it's only allowed to direct people to employment if they're unemployed. So it can't direct people from one job to another, like the authorities can do in New Zealand. It can only direct people who are unemployed into employment. So it's a much, and there's not much unemployment because so many people are joining the army, so it's a much less broad-based policy. It's modified in January 1943, so they get the unlimited power of direction that their New Zealand counterparts have, but it's only ever used in a very limited way. There's a real fear about industrial conscription in Australia. So the total number of directions, which if you remember in New Zealand was over 166,000, in Australia it's less than 13,500. And remember, of course, the population of Australia is significantly larger. So New Zealand actually directs more people in just 2 months than Australia does in the entire war. So again, much more extensive. Canada. In a way, the situation is somewhat similar to Australia. The legacy of the First World War hangs very heavily. So Canada had conscripted for overseas service from 1917, but again, it was the subject of bitter divides. Particularly the French Canadians in Quebec had raised extensive resistance. There had been violence, there had been riots, some people had been shot as part of those riots in the First World War. So Second World War Prime Minister William Mackenzie King was desperate to avoid conscripting for overseas service in Canada because of what it could mean for national unity and because of what it could mean for his government that was heavily dependent on Quebec votes. So when conscription does come in June 1940 with the National Resources Mobilisation Act, it's similar to Australia in that conscripts cannot be sent overseas. So people can be conscripted for service in Canada and its territorial waters, but they can't be sent to Europe, they can't be sent to North Africa or wherever else they might be sent to. Pressure for conscription grows, and in 1942 the government holds a plebiscite to ask the Canadian people whether they want conscription for overseas service or not. The result comes back yes, overall, but in Quebec it comes back as a resounding no. So Mackenzie King fudges the issue. He comes up with his very famous phrase that it's conscription if necessary, but not necessarily conscription, which is a beautiful piece of political jargon. So basically the government can now conscript for overseas service, but it won't, because it's too afraid of what it will mean. only in November 1944, which is incredibly late, and is partly because there's a real shortage of frontline infantrymen for the Canadian forces in Europe. They've been cut up badly fighting around Antwerp, so they needed more frontline infantrymen. They were absolutely desperate. The only reserve of trained manpower they had was the conscripts who'd been trained up in Canada, who by this point were known as zombies, because they'd been on home service for so long, and they'd become quite derided by a lot of the population. So in November 1944, Canada passes a special order in council to conscript 16,000 men, and that's written in, so it's limited to 16,000 men who will be sent overseas for conscript service. By the time the war ends, less than 10,000 of them have reached the front line. Only around 2,000 of them actually end up fighting in combat. So, as I said, the vast majority of Canadians who fight in the Second World War do so as volunteers. The total number of conscripts in Canada is around 160,000, so that's all the ones who are called up for home service, which is about twice the number conscripted in New Zealand, but Canada's population is 8.5 times larger. So again, military conscription is much greater in New Zealand. Canada does have industrial conscription, called National Selective Service, but it's only ever applied in a very fragmented way. Labour turnover continues at about 10% each month, which is really not good if you're trying to manage your employment situation and have a sort of scientifically directed war effort. They have so-called compulsory transfer orders, which are kind of like New Zealand's directions, from non-essential industries to essential, but they're applied so loosely that when there's the thought of issuing more in 1944, the authorities basically say that it's not worth it, and they can the scheme because it just hasn't worked. And in November 1944, the manpower authorities hold a survey of the Canadian population when they ask Canadians, have you been contacted by a National Selective Service officer and have you had engagement with them? 67% of the Canadian population said they'd had no contact with a Selective Service officer. So after 2.5 years of the scheme being in operation, 2/3 of Canadians hadn't even been contacted by them, let alone moved or conscripted. So again, it's clear, at least to me, that industrial conscription in New Zealand is far more extensive than it's in Canada. So just to conclude, at the end of the World War 100 centenary program, they did a final survey where they asked New Zealanders what they'd learned or what they'd taken from the World War 100 program. Only 36% knew that New Zealand introduced conscription in the First World War, which to me is quite a frighteningly low number. I think it's pretty bad that New Zealanders don't know that their country conscripted in the First World War. I think if something is if it's repeated for the Second World War, and as we move towards the Second World War centenary, I think it would be disastrous if the story of conscription is not told. Because conscription is so extensive in New Zealand, because it's so integral to its war effort, both military and industrial, surely it needs to feature more heavily in the historiography. Surely we need to acknowledge, I'm not saying it's a bad thing or a good thing, but surely we need to acknowledge the role of conscription in New Zealand's war effort and start to think about, what did this mean? Were they happy to be conscripts? If we're talking about combat morale and performance, surely it's important how the men got there in the first place. What did New Zealanders feel about this massively pervasive moving of men and women around the country? How did they react to it? What did it make them feel about the war effort and the part that they were having in it? So I think it raises so many questions. But until we start to acknowledge just how important conscription is, we can't really start to ask and answer those questions the way I think we can. And as I said, it seems to me that the apt comparison is New Zealand, Australia, Canada. They're the ones whose wars are broadly similar in terms of distance from the combat zone. They're all colonies of the British Empire, etc. And New Zealand's application of conscription is much more extensive. So rather than comparing New Zealand to Britain, I think we should be comparing New Zealand to those two countries. If I haven't bored you sufficiently, I have suggested some extra reading. Two articles by David Littlewood is pretty good. And even better, they're both online and they're both free to access. So you can access them without any kind of subscription. Deborah Montgomery's book is really good. She only talks about women conscription. She's talked about male conscription, but it's very good on that side of things. And really, for me at least, the best book on New Zealand society in the Second World War, despite the fact it's quite old now, is Nancy Taylor's volume of the English history. Thank you.
I'm sure there must be many questions you want to ask David, given that most of our parents would have been involved. Mm-hmm. Yep.
My father was in the Home Guard, and he was afraid of the Japanese. All he had was a Lenfield rifle with about five or six bullets, and he had to keep one bullet in his pocket. That was for himself, because he didn't want to be taken prisoner by the Japanese.
Yeah, so yeah. In the newspapers at the time, there's all sorts of stories about how, the Home Guard was impressive in terms of numbers, but in terms of equipment.
Yes, and Turukina Beach, because it was so flat, the Home Guard and the Rangitiki believed that's where the Japanese would land at night, at 1 o'clock in the morning.
It would be interesting to know if many of those 34 men that were incarcerated in Lake Alice had been conscripted. I don't think their research goes into that.
Most of them were World War One, weren't they? Yeah.
Some of them were World War II.
I think their military records will probably indicate whether they were conscripted or not. You know, if you were able to pick those records up out of Defence Force, out of Barracks Point.
They're all in that book that
they produced.
Okay.
Richard?
Oh, well, firstly, you talk about balloting in the conscription process. Was this a matter of simply choosing birth dates, or was this some... Was there a kind of random luck that you could not be balloted?
I've got the picture for the present house. The picture for the poster was because Bob Semple actually drew the first marble from the ballot, which was ironic for a lot of people because he'd been arrested for opposing conscription in the First World War. Everyone's name was put in, and it was actually a really lengthy process. Some of the first ballots took, because you drew the marble and the marble corresponded to a drawer which had names in, and then you had to draw another marble which was the number of the person. So the first ballots took a couple of days, because they were balloting sort of 16,000 people at a time, so it took a long time. There was one case where one of the ladies who was conducting the ballot was found to have taken her boyfriend's name out of the urn. And there were a couple of other allegations of impropriety that weren't proven, but that one was. So. Yeah, but it was meant to be luck, and I think in a way that's one reason why conscription is accepted by most people. It was seen as being... The problem with volunteering is you tended to have some families that sent all their sons and some families that sent none, whereas at least with conscription it was frequently described as the fairest or the most democratic way. And obviously the idea of fairness had a really big currency in New Zealand at the time, so for a lot of people, they were arguing for conscription because it was fair. It would stop that one man going, the people across the street not going.
So. Other questions?
Were the land girls, were they part of the industrial conscription, and were they in both wars?
Because when I talk about essential industries, one of the interesting things is that farming was never declared essential industry. The farmers themselves actually didn't want to be, because they said, A, we're seasonal, so if you have people tied to farming, that doesn't really take account of men coming in and out over the harvest. And they also said that our employees are more like members of the family, so the idea of them being tied to us doesn't really take that into account. So farming and agriculture was never declared essential industry, so you couldn't actually direct people to farming, so the land guilds are volunteers.
I had, as a schoolboy in World War II, I mean, manpower was quite a feared word.
Yeah.
And I had one uncle who had been working on the railways, building the railway up to Marlborough, and they opened a linen flax factory, working 24 hours, making coverings for planes, early planes. And so he was drafted, shifted around, as you said.
Yeah.
As you said, and 1943, it just changed. I can remember that. It was a lot less.
Yeah, there were certainly some industries that were very unpopular, things like the freezing works, canning factories, tanneries were really unpopular. So, yeah, whenever you, if you look in the newspaper, it's often referred to as the manpower, as you said, and yet it's often talked about in quite a pejorative way, the manpower is going to get you, or and they often, when in 1944 there was a fear that people were sort of dodging the system, so the manpower officers actually did sweeps of bars and theatres to try and catch people who hadn't signed up. So,
Any other?
In your book, are you going to be mentioning about the first furlough?
Yes. Probably not too extensively, because I think Jonathan Fennell's covered it so well, but it will be in there, and the replacement scheme as well for in 1944.
What are your sources for the extensive volunteerism of Maori during the war? I'd say that because by the middle of the war, and this is speaking to Freiburg's PA, the battalion was short of manpower and they had to have to move non-Maori into a lot of the positions.
Yeah. I think part of it's political. The government really didn't want to conscript Maori anyway, so they did set the bar reasonably low, but it was sort of a quid pro quo. There were a couple of times in 1941 where they sort of mooted the idea of conscription for Maori and basically said if certain iwi, those who were perceived as not doing enough, didn't step up, then they would consider it. So they kind of use it as a stick.
Then have you looked at the propaganda, if you could put it that way, of what the government did to try and encourage Maori during the middle of the war to enlist?
I haven't looked into that too much. No, that's part of the book. It still needs to be.
Well, I was just going to say, your remarks about Australia's relatively loose or more mild system probably explains why Australia, as I understand it, was notorious for strikes, especially in dockside workers and a lot of the what you would consider important industries. They seem to be going on strike at the drop of a hat.
Yeah, I mean, there still were plenty of strikes in New Zealand, and that was... again, a tool that was often used to beat the government with. I mean, some historians have argued that one reason why the government in New Zealand introduced conscription and forced it through a little bit was because they were so afraid of being tarred as the conscience of the First World War, so that they needed and that's one reason perhaps why the people were getting subjected so badly. You know, they needed to be seen as cracking down, or they would be, we're all beholden to the unions, or you don't really believe in conscription anyway.
I'm curious, was the government at the time reluctant to put Maori men under arms?
I haven't really come across that too much. I mean, the Labour Party commanded a lot of Maori votes. I mean, you know, the Maori seats, the Maori MPs turned into vote and support the Labour government. So I don't think so much it's that. I think it was more that fear of resistance. I mean, in the First World War, they'd only conscripted one particular iwi for a limited period of time. It led to a huge amount of resistance and problems, and there were all sorts of problems of actually getting accurate registers, call up. So I think they basically decided that just wasn't worth the effort, wasn't worth the angst, provided they kept volunteering to at least some kind of acceptable degree, that was better than risking a complete explosion by trying to conscript them. But as I said, they did have that industrial conscription, but the government made very careful that it was under the Maori War Effort organisation that was tribally based, tribally run, and so it was effectively Maori conscripting other Maori rather than, you know, Europeans going in and doing it. And as I said, some historians have said, you know, the government could have used this as a basis for post-war,
you know, co-governance.
But they didn't.
If you read into it, we actually had an MP here in Palmerston North, Mafete or Moffat, was very heavily involved in that Maori manpower, you know, war effort. But the competition between the different iwi in terms of who was going to provide force, particularly the 28th Maori Battalion when it was established here in Palmerston North in early 1940, is actually quite interesting. And that's, you know, when they looked at how the different companies within the battalion were set up. They were set up on geographical or even, you know, tribal lines. It was interesting to see which tribes were prepared to actually support and be able to put enough manpower in those companies and which weren't. But that's a whole, that's another book. In fact, Honi Sutra, I think, has done very well in his book, Te Fiti. It's a very interesting account of how they went about it. So it wasn't so much that they didn't do it during World War II, they'd actually left it to Maori themselves. He did exceptionally well in terms of contributing to the likes of the 28th Maori Battalion and other forces. So, all right, somebody shaking. That's a topic for another. Stuart.
Yeah. Well, is there a clear definition then as to who was or wasn't Maori?
That was one of the problems. I mean, sometimes when you have the appeal boards, people are coming forward saying, you know, I shouldn't have been ballotted in the first place because I'm actually Maori. So that's one of the problems that the government has. I mean, in 1941, they asked the what was the Native Affairs Department to draw up a register of Maori men that could have formed the basis for conscription. The Native Affairs Department basically says, we just don't have the manpower, the knowledge to do that. And so, yeah, there were all sorts of administrative. And I think that's one reason why the government thought that, you know, volunteering is working, at least to some degree, much better that than conscription, which would just be a mess.
Okay, look, thanks very much. I think, can you just all join me again in thanking David very much for